project in like there. The other side of this one-page handout, very interesting. There was a man, Everard Titon du Tillet, who compiled a book of all the famous people who were in the arts in France. It comes out, I think, in 1729, just the year that that she dies. And it's not just music, it's anything in the arts. And there are little biographies of all these famous people. But there are only four engravings and sort of coins or that are of any of them, of musicians. And one of these four, and the only woman in the entire book, is Jacqueline Laguerre. And this is a reproduction of both sides of that coin. And again, if you look at it, the top one is in, she's now older than in that other portrait. But again, you see somebody who's very assertive and looking very sure of herself. And the other side is something really interesting. It shows her sitting at the keyboard. So it shows two things that she does. There she's playing the harpsichord, and she's looking over her shoulder at an amazingly chaotic but huge bunch of scores on the floor. Right? That's her music. You know? So she's in the middle of this very productive life. It shows both things that she does. She's both a composer and a musician. And what it says there, au grand musicien, j'ai disputé le prix. Whether this is an exact quote of something she said, I don't know. What that means is, among the great musicians, I am vying for the prize. I deserve to be there with them. So, and it says I. So it's maybe her who said that. So there she is, in all of her glory, I think. There's not all that much written about her, but any of you who read French, there's one really wonderful biography of her, really, really very good. You can look at it afterwards. Catherine says it's in French. It's not been translated that I know of. But it goes through her whole life, and sort of every piece she wrote, and what it's like, who are the connections she had. Doesn't say anything about what I'm talking about, because it's speculative, I think. So I wanted to talk now about this connection between these two composers, which I think is really a very strong connection. There were homage pieces written throughout the Baroque by all sorts of composers about different things, about La Forqueray, La Couperin. In France, there were many things like this. There was no piece called Le Jacquet or Le Laguerre. Nobody honored her that way. But I think Couperin honored her by the whole second ode that he writes. I want to go through as to why I think that, and then go through some of the pieces that way. So number one, if you look at the first piece in her that I played, the Allemande, called La Flamande. What does that mean? It really means Flemish, the Flemish person. And one of the theories is that the dance, although it's Allemande, should be German, because maybe this particular type of Allemande came from Flemish, Flanders. I don't think that's necessarily it. I never heard of any Allemandes coming from Flanders, really. But there was a theory back then, it was back then as it is now, really, that in the north, it was a much poorer region. And there were people who were who came down from what is now called Belgium, and they worked in factories, they worked in domestic service, and so this could be about that. And Couperin's first piece, the Allemande, is called La Laborieuse, and that actually does mean what it sounds like in English too, somebody who is working really hard at very detailed and very complicated. Detailed work, like there's a portrait I just happened to see in Paris about a year ago of someone with the title of that painting is called La Laborieuse, and it's somebody doing needlepoint, very, very, very intently with her daughter looking on. Or think about what the craft of composition is. So also the style of those pieces, usually François Couperin's Allemandes are very grandiose and very noble, dotted notes, huge, and they're elegy pieces. This one is not like that. This is a lot of running 16th notes, just like hers. So there's a connection that I think is there because of that. His piece that starts, her courant, which had that figure that you might remember, you'll hear this in a minute. Her courant starts with this. figure goes out throughout that piece that you might remember. That's the same theme in La Laborieuse, as you'll hear. It starts off with that exact same quote. So maybe I'm fishing a little bit, but I think there's that's there. Okay. All of the dances then follow. There's Courante, Sarabande, again, very similar French and Italian styles. And then you get to the second piece that the gigue that I played was is a very odd type of a gigue. It's called a gigue lourée. It's not this fast, boisterous gigue they're used to. It's a gigue that you don't find at all in harpsichord music except for Jacquet's one. And Couperin doesn't write any gigue in his second org, but he writes a piece called La Charolaise, which is a character piece, but it's exactly the same kind of piece, and it comes in the same spot right after the Sarabande. The rigodons, Couperin only writes one set. The only rigodons he writes for keyboard, the only ones are the ones I'm going to play for you that are in the second org. And again, it's a two-voice piece with lots of ornaments, not like the rigodons he writes in chamber music, but exactly the same style as hers, which you remember, again, two-voice, lots of ornaments, very sort of gutsy. And then after that came the Chaconne, which was, again, I think, her masterpiece. And what comes after that in the Couperin org is a piece called La Terpsichore, or Terpsichore, one of the muse of the arts. And there was, and when she published her first set of harpsichord pieces back in 1686, there was a poem that went along with it that somebody wrote and had an before the piece start. And it's called La Terpsichore. And what it says is, I see Terpsichore, or Terpsichore, at the harpsichord. It should be Jacquet Laguerre, who is this muse, or we're mistaken and we should have a 10th muse devoted to her. So it's somebody who really thought a lot of her. And so what came out of that was that became her nickname, is that she was then known as La Terpsichore because of this. And so here's this piece. And again, it's very much like this Chaconne. This comes right exactly in the middle of this Ode of Couperin. It's like the centerpiece. It's a big, bold piece with the same kind of dotted notes. I think it's, if there's any real visceral connection between the two of these compositions, it's in fact that piece. You'll hear some direct quotes, but you'll hear definitely the style. It's very noble and very godlike, really, because Terpsichore was was one of the muses. So that's there. And after that come a whole bunch of character pieces. The dances are really sort of finished, and each one of them, I think, has a connection. So the one that comes right after that is called Les Idées Heureuses. I made a little mention of that before. This is a piece, I think, that was near and dear to Couperin, because, again, there's his hand on that piece. He really thought it was an important piece. I'll let you decide what you think of the piece if you don't already know it. It's one of his most gorgeous compositions. And what it means, it can't really be translated as happy ideas. It's not that. It really refers to happier times, or times when either things that were really, remembering back to really wonderful times, or times that might someday be. It's thinking about hearkening back to really important happiness or period. What's noticeable in the piece is that there are all these things that sound cadential, but they don't resolve. It's like he goes there and then he comes back. It happens over and over again, especially in the second half. And I think it's like, to me, maybe I'm projecting, but it's like she is, or he is, wanting something that he can't get. It takes you all the way to the end of the piece before you really hear a resolution, before it just goes there and then comes back all the time. Full of chromaticism. After that, la diligence. What does that mean? Same word, diligent. A hard worker, somebody who works all the time. And what you'll notice in that piece is sometimes the same figure repeated over and over again. It's like trying to get something right. If she was anything, it was a hard worker. She worked all the time. There she is with the quill in her hand. So I think that refers to her. La flatteuse, again, really interesting. What that means is a flatterer, someone who flatters somebody. Flattery in the 18th century and 17th century was an extremely pejorative term. If somebody was a flatterer, it was a terrible thing to call somebody. It meant somebody who was obsequious, somebody who was wheedling, trying to get somewhere. But he presents this in a way that also he calls it to be played with much affection and with a lot of affect. And it is a very sympathetic piece. And I think what he's doing is he's thinking about himself. He'll do anything to try to either become a friend of hers again or maybe something more than that. But he doesn't like calling himself a flatterer, but I think he is. And the piece itself is in the form of a lure, which is a dance that is like a slow jig. The rhythmic pattern is bum bum ba, bum bum ba. And lures, there aren't that many lures in French music. There's usually one in every opera. And a lot of times, it's a grotesque piece. It's a piece that exotic people are dancing or monsters are dancing. It wasn't like one of the fashionable court dancing. So, I mean, grotesque in the sense of being exotic, not our sense of the word grotesque. And I think he's painting a picture of himself here, you know, but sympathetic, but, you know, and that's followed by La Voluptueuse. Again, I don't think I need to translate that, nor do I need to say who it's referring to. It's not a mystery as to why it comes right after La Voluptueuse. And it's a piece, now, if you think about, before you even hear this piece, what a piece like with a name like that would sound like, you might be surprised. It's a very, it's a piece that is very, it has a lot of affect, it's emotional, but it's much drier than the piece before. It's like, has a lot more restraint to it. And I think this would be like his response. Yeah, okay, fine, but, you know, I'm not going to go any further than maybe what it is. And then he ends with a piece called Les Papillons. Papillon, French, now means butterfly, or even bow tie. Back then, there are a number of different meanings for it, and one of them is that, you know, they had all these wonderful court balls, and if you think about these glittering rooms where they had these balls, filled with candlelight, right? And women wore these diamond barrettes in their hair, and as they danced and whirled around, there'd be these flashes of light that came out of that. And that was called papillon. These were these papillons, just brilliant flashes of light. And you're certainly going to hear that in there. But there's another 18th century and 17th century meaning of that word. And it's a whole phrase called faire le papillon, to do the papillon. What it means really is to play a practical joke on somebody. It also means making a sucker out of somebody. Oh, la faire le papillon. It means if somebody did some maybe harsh or cruel joke on you. I think this is Couperin saying, okay, I've done everything I can. I can't do any more. So it's a way of just coming away from the emotional part and trying to get away from it. I can't do this anymore. And he, you know, we know so much about her life, that she was very happy until all these tragedies happened, that she was so prolific. We know very little, we know hardly anything about him. He's this famous person. Not one letter, nothing personal at all about him. We know he got married, we know the name of his wife, but that the only thing we know about her is her name, period. There was absolutely nothing from before she married or afterwards about. So we don't know what his marriage was like, his personal life was like. We know that the last 10 years of his life or so, he was a hypochondriac. He's always complaining about being in ill health and moping around and trying to get away from society. But you don't get a picture of a happy, you get a picture of someone who's maybe not quite so happy. The homage piece that I know so well, I'm not going to play it today because it's not part of this, is a piece that Forqueray wrote called La Couperin. And it's a piece that's very, very noble. It's a great piece, but it's also a very profoundly, I think, sad piece with the dissonances in it. It's not at all, it's not like an elegy, really. It's more like this is his character, somebody who was not ever really in a good mood. I don't know. But it's unbelievably profound, great music. And I think that what he's doing in this second ode, I mean, again, the place of it, the first ode is dedicated to the king, as it had to be. The second one, I think, really is dedicated to her. And I'm going to start off with the prelude in the same key that comes out of his method of how to play the harpsichord. Thank you. questions you have about anything.
Thank you so much for gracing us with your presence, for your historical expertise, and for your phenomenal playing.
Oh, thank
you. We really appreciate it.
Long-time relationship. It must have occurred to them to play, if not write, some duets.
I'm sure they probably didn't play duets. It wouldn't surprise me that they would have.
But they didn't write duets?
Well, there are a number of pieces that he wrote that are, in fact, two harpsichord pieces. There's the gorgeous Allemande, there are those musettes that he wrote, among others, about five or six pieces.
But no indication that they played them together.
No. In fact, we have no instance of them ever even meeting. There's not even something we said, well, Cooper was here and Jackie Legere was there. Nobody ever mentions it. But it's impossible that it didn't happen. So there are too many connections there. Right there. Yeah, but as far as duets, I can't imagine they probably would have gotten together. There were these musical evenings all the time. I mean, what happened in the Bach family didn't just happen in the Bach family, people getting together and just playing all the time. Yeah.
Did Elizabeth Jacquet write for the organ at all?
I don't think she did, actually. Okay. I think she maybe left that to her husband.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't want to get in his way. Maybe.
Yeah, not necessarily.
Yeah. But no, we don't know any organ works.
Okay.
In fact, I guess if the sacred cantatas, I think they sound better if they're accompanied on harpsichord, actually, because they sound like secular cantatas just happen to have a sacred text. But no, there are no organ pieces that I know of. Interesting. Yeah, I never thought of that before. No.
You think she ever subbed for him and you couldn't?
Yeah, possible. Yeah, could very well be. Yeah, these things were handed down generation by, you know, when Cooper and I got his job at Saint-Gervais, his father died when he was 11, and he was given the post already at age 11. But then I think it was Dallon or something that said he'll do it until Couperin becomes of age, but it was Couperin's position. It stayed in the family. We'll enjoy all the rest of the harpsichords. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.